Yeah. Welcome to the Soulcast. Today's guest is Carlo Piantini. Carlo was one of the 200 and plus people who were mass arrested in Washington, D.C. on January 20th for the inauguration of Donald Trump. For those who've seen the videos of the fierce resistance that took place on that day, I mean, everybody I know that's seen was super inspired by the resistance that happened out there. And at a certain point during the day, from what I've gathered, they just mass arrested a large group of people indiscriminately. And Carlo was one of those people and is looking at 75 years in prison. So we're going to have a conversation today because it's the week of solidarity with the J20 arrestees who are all looking at 75 years in prison. We're talking about that's a long fucking time. We're going to talk about all the things that the state has done to try to force pleas from people, targeting people in relationships and just, you know, piling on felonies. When I first heard about the Disrupt J20 protest, I made plans to go. I had fully intended on flying out there and participating in this. And my money got fucked up, and so I couldn't afford to do it. And to think that could be me looking at 75 years just for protesting Trump, it's mind-blowing. And, you know, my heart goes out to everyone who's facing down these charges. And I'm super inspired and moved by how brave and how these people are fighting back. And they're not going to kneel. And to everyone out there who's looking at charges, you know, I just want to extend my solidarity and gratitude. So to those who don't know about what's going on or know what's going on and want to learn more, this is a fucking awesome interview. And anyone who's out there, you know, fighting the power, actually resisting, you know, I think there's a lot to learn from what we're going to be talking about and all the resources and frameworks that these J20 defendants are using. It's super inspiring. So check out this interview with Carlo. And if you're moved, I highly encourage people to do whatever they can, wherever they are, to get the fucking word out about what's happening and to make the phone calls and write the letters and put pressure on the people who have the power to make this shit go away. At the very minimum, you can do a bake sale, do whatever. As you hear through this interview, there's a desperate need for finances to get people to pay their court costs and legal fees. So, I mean, there's so many things you can do. And one last point I would like to make about this interview is that Carlo doing this interview is choosing not to be anonymous, is choosing to step out front and say, hey, you know what? This happened to me. I'm a fucking human being. I'm a real person. And typically, you know, when in the past, when I was arrested or when people get arrested, they, your lawyers tell you, don't speak to the press. Don't say anything. And when you're dealing with political repression on this scale, it requires different tactics, different strategies, and a different way of thinking. So I hope people get a lot out of this interview. I certainly did. And, you know, do what you can for the J20 resistors. And let's keep these motherfuckers out of prison. All right. Without further ado, I present to you Carlo. Carlo, what's up? Welcome to the Soulcast.
Hey, y'all. Thanks so much for having me. It's good to be here.
Oh, I mean, you know, it sucks we're having this conversation under such shitty circumstances.
Yeah, state repression is, it's always pretty shitty when it happens, but as with everything else, we deal with it and we fight back hard against it.
Yeah, and as y'all are, that's for sure. Well, so this week is like the week of J20 solidarity for people who were arrested in D.C. and you were one of the people who were rounded up on January 20th at the Inauguration Day protest against Trump. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what happened that day and why you went out and just what J20 was?
Definitely. Because I am currently a defendant, there are going to be certain aspects of that day which I cannot talk about for my own protection, for the protection of my co-defendants. But J20 was a day of resistance. It was Donald Trump's inauguration, and there was a widespread feeling that this horrible day of what would have been mourning needed to be turned into a day of very active resistance. And so thousands of people went to D.C. to resist in various ways in terms of their capacity. There were blockades. There were several marches. There was the Festival of Resistance, which was all of this was organized under the banner of Disrupt J20. And one of those events was an anti-capitalist and anti-fascist march. I was a participant in the march. I chose to go to D.C. because, one, fuck Donald Trump, and two, because I see a very clear and horrifying rise in white nationalism and fascism within the United States right now. And as an anarchist and an anti-fascist, I believe that that has to be fought back against as hard and actively as possible. During the anti-capitalist march, the Metropolitan Police Department, along with the Parks Police Department in D.C., they engaged in pretty crazy brutality and violence against the demonstrators. An official report from the Office of Police Complaints in D.C. notes that they used chemical weapons, they used concussion and percussion grenades against protesters without provocation. They used this as a means of crowd control and ultimately as a way to engage in what is called a kettle. Kettling is a technique where police will form lines in order to cut off entire city sections. In this case, they cut off the corner of L and 12th Street. And then they mass arrest everyone who was in the kettle. So demonstrators and along with bystanders, along with legal observers, along with journalists, along with street medics, they were all held within the kettle for 4 hours. They were held without food, without water, without medical attention. Several people were forced to urinate on themselves. They didn't have access to bathrooms. During holding, certain protesters were subjected to sexual assault as a punitive measure by the police. So it was essentially just some pretty fucked up shit by the police.
So can I cut you off real quick? When you say Absolutely. When you say sexual assault, what do you specifically mean?
The ACLU of D.C. has filed a lawsuit against the Metropolitan Police Department. And in that lawsuit, they argue that the police subjected protesters to unnecessarily invasive cavity searches. They inserted their fingers inside of certain protesters' anuses, and they also molested them by tugging on their testicles, male-bodied protesters. That is what I mean. It is understood that this was used as a punitive measure. It was a form of abusing protesters. It was essentially rape as a form of punishment. When police engage in this kind of activity, which we've seen a lot of that, particularly in the last few years, most notably in France with someone who was raped with a police baton. You know, when the cops do this, it's a way of asserting power and control over the people who they've arrested.
Right. Yeah, that's I've never heard of anything like that happening ever. I mean, not at a protest. I mean, That's some, I mean, that's crazy.
It's pretty horrible and very, very disgusting. You know, but the police are going to be the police. And when you put people in positions of authority and power, that power and authority is very often abused. And, you know, occasionally it's abused in very sadistic and very horrible ways. And in this instance, that's what happened.
And okay. So a bunch of y'all were mass arrested and now, well, when you were first arrested, like what were you all charged with? And then how did that change? Like now you're all looking at 75 years, right? Like over 200 people looking at 75 years.
That's correct. When we were first arrested, all roughly 230 people who were arrested were charged with a single count of felony rioting, which is an unprecedented charge in D.C. in particular, because felony rioting is not a charge in D.C. There is no statute for a felony charge of rioting under the D.C. Riot Act. There is only a statute for misdemeanor rioting. So we were charged with a crime that does not exist. From then, several months later in April, a grand jury returned with a superseding indictment that filed 8 different felony charges for all 200 some odd protesters. And those charges include inciting to riot, riot, conspiracy to riot, and 5 counts of property destruction for every single defendant in the case.
And I mean, from what I know, you know, there were, like, from what I've seen, there were windows smashed and there was some property destruction, like during the course of the day, but it only adds up to what, like $100,000 or something, right?
Yeah. Supposedly that's the estimated total amount of property destruction.
And you know, that's inflated anyway.
Absolutely. I mean, That's from my understanding, yes. And what's very ironic is that because of the police conduct on that day, there is an investigation that is opening up to look at the police conduct. And that investigation is actually going to cost the people of D.C. $150,000, which is like $50,000 more than the alleged property destruction. I think that's a little ironic, but that's just me.
Well, if you can't cry, laugh.
Exactly.
Well, I just did the math on that. So 75 years in prison for 200 people is 15,000 years. That's like that's like the next ice age.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we live that long, you know, if climate change doesn't get to us first. But I hadn't done that math. That's really staggering when you hear that number that way.
It is a staggering number. I mean, that's like basically when Christ was walking around with the dinosaurs, you know?
Oh, my God. Wow. Good times back then, at least. Simpler from what I understand.
Things are simpler back then. That's crazy about the $150,000, not to mention the fact that those businesses are all insured. And,
mm-hmm. You know, that situation is going to resolve itself. And while I can't speak to the property destruction that took place, what I can say is that the breaking of windows is not comparable to the scale and the magnitude of the violence of the police on that day. You know, the streets of D.C. felt like a war zone. There were concussion grenades exploding in the middle of the street. There were elderly women and children who were maced by the police and nearly trampled, who had to be saved by members of the protest itself. There were people beaten in the streets. When we talk as anarchists about the evils of the system that we live under, that main evil is the fact that this society inherently values property over people's lives, you know, and because of that, the state gets to dictate what violence looks like. But for anyone who was on that street that day, the violence was coming certainly from the police, and it was very extreme and very terrifying, I'm certain, for a lot of people, because there were certainly protesters out there, but there were bystanders out there, and there were family members out there. J20 was in very many ways a festive, celebratory event. You had the Festival of Resistance happening only a few blocks away, where people were there with their children. And here on another street, you had the police going crazy and engaging in a full-out assault on people. It was very extreme.
Have you had a chance to look at the discovery?
I have had a chance to look at the discovery. I can't discuss the discovery. I have been able to look at some of the publicly available footage, though, and a bit of the live streams that have come out of that day.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, like, what do you, or do you know anything, like, what I'm curious about is, like, are these crazy charges coming from, you know, coming from the top? You know, is like Jeff Sessions saying, hey, you know what, like, we can't have anarchists, you know, taking this, like, you know what I mean? Like, or is that all like here? Is that all speculative right now?
Well, Jeff Sessions issued a directive nationally to all prosecutors saying, listen, we need to target protesters when protesters are arrested. I want you to come up with the largest number and the most severe charges possible in every instance, right? And we're seeing that across the country. We're seeing that with water protectors who were arrested at Standing Rock. There are over 800 cases open right now of water protectors. We are seeing that in Sacramento right now with anti-fascists who are currently facing charges for confronting the Traditionalist Workers Party, which is a neo-Nazi party. We are seeing that with comrades in Pittsburgh, for example, who participated in noise demos outside the Allegheny jail. Right now, we're seeing very wide-scale repression. And in terms of the J20 charges, what has happened is that those charges have been conceived through a grand jury. Grand juries are a very, very secretive and very, very poorly understood aspect of our legal system. They are descendant from British colonialism. Essentially, it is a open jury in which there is no judge presiding over the jury and there is no defense attorney present for the witness who is being called. The prosecution runs the entire grand jury and is allowed to bring in whatever they want to consider as evidence to present in front of the jury to secure the charges that they feel that they need. And, you know, there's a very famous quote that's like, a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich if, like, the prosecutor tells them to. They are essentially witch hunts that the public is not allowed to have any information about. The proceedings are sealed as a matter of record, and prosecutors use them all the time. A grand jury just opened up here in North Carolina we're not sure why at the moment, but we have another member of our community here, Katie Yao, who is currently being subpoenaed to face a grand jury on July 31st. They're a very useful tool for the state to destroy communities and to engage in political repression.
Right. And so for people who don't really understand what a grand jury is, you know, if I'm called before a grand jury, I do not have the right to plead the fifth. I can't plead the fifth. you have to answer all their questions, correct?
So normally in any kind of case, you can plead the fifth, which is the right not to incriminate yourself. But when you go in front of a grand jury, the grand jury can grant you immunity. They can grant you immunity in the case, and through that they can be like, okay, now you do not have the possibility to incriminate yourself. Now you must answer our questions. And if you do not answer their questions, you can be held in civil contempt and thrown in jail for the duration of the grand jury, which it can last up to 18 months. So without charging you for a crime, you can be held in jail for a year and a half by choosing to resist a grand jury.
Yeah, I just have learned about it, you know, whatever, 4 years ago was the first time I'd heard about it. I was just blown away by it. One of the quotes I really liked was from, I think his name is Jerry Koch.
Jerry, yeah.
And he's fucking awesome. And he gave a talk out here because he was a grand jury resister, and he ended up going to prison for it. And one of the best things he said is, like, you know, when people think about these grand juries, they don't think about, you know, like, he's like, everybody I was in there with were like, you know, alleged gangsters or alleged drug dealers or whatever. And, like, you know, none of those motherfuckers snitch either. Like, he was in there with a whole bunch of people snitching. He's like, but, you know, nobody celebrates them. But really, like, that practice of not talking to grand juries, you know, it's not just for anarchists, it's for everybody.
No, I mean, not cooperating with the state is a principle that's found across communities, and it's one of our strongest, it's like one of our foundational principles. It has to be, because when we cooperate with the state, we're turning our backs on our movements and on our communities, and ultimately on the relationships that we've built. Because when the state wants you to cooperate, it's so that they can put someone in prison.
Right.
So not doing that is absolutely essential to any kind of resistance movement. We cannot choose to cooperate with the state.
When I listen to you talk, you know, you don't sound scared. You don't, you know, you sound very, you know, well supported. Can you talk about how the support you're getting, or like what kind of support you're getting, and, you know, how it's making this process a little more manageable for you?
Absolutely. And what I can say is that the strongest level of support has actually come through my co-defendants. When we're turned into co-defendants by the state, that's a trauma that we all go through, right? Because it's the beginning of criminalization, and criminalization is a form of trauma. But through that situation, the state also forces a point of affinity to emerge between what amounts to complete strangers. And if you hold on, and if you grab that point of affinity, and you love it and you nurture it and you turn it into relationships, then your co-defendants can be your strongest level of support if you don't let the state isolate you. The state wants to horrify you out of speaking to your co-defendants, and out of working with them and out of organizing with them to build your defense against your repression. And sometimes that works, because when you're looking down the barrel at 75 years, that's a tall glass of water, you know.
Jesus.
And sometimes you have lawyers who will also come in and tell you, you know, you are putting yourself in danger by speaking to such and such. So everything wants to work against you, but if you fight back against that, those are the people who we can build real solidarity with, because we're going through the struggle together. We can fight together. We can have each other's backs. And in this case, at least amongst my co-defendants, that's really happened. And we've all held each other like on the line in such a beautiful way. We've been building our defense together, and we have been holding support group sessions for one another, and we've been meeting with each other to build real relationships with one another, and it's been absolutely incredible. And without them, I don't know if I could have gotten through this situation with whatever level of composure I've had. Beyond that, we have had supporters and veterans from the anarchist movement come out of the woodworks, people who I have never known before, strangers, who have told me point blank, next year and a half, I am here for you, and I will do everything that I can to get you through this. We have had folks from Dead City Legal Posse in D.C., you know, provide housing for us and, like, secure jail solidarity for Dane Powell, who was the defendant who was recently sentenced to 4 months inside. We have had just a number of people working in public relations, helping us develop media, and people helping us to develop a legal clinic so that we can begin forming a more consolidated legal strategy. What I can say to people who are facing repression is, if you make the choice to stand strong, there will be people who come behind you and hold their hands to your back and keep you standing. And love those people, cherish those people, treat them right. And when we get out of this, pay it forward and put that work in to, you know, support the people who will be facing repression next. We can either let that repression break us, or we can work through that repression and make it a situation where we develop this movement even further and we become stronger.
Yeah, I mean, because there's no way, you know, they can't have 212 of these cases, you know, going to trial. They just want to get a couple pleas. So
they're aching for pleas, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're doing everything they can. So, shout out to North Carolina. I was listening to the Final Straw interview with the Tilted Scales Collective. Are you familiar with them?
Yes, yes.
I have to say, if I can,
Tilted Scales has come out to support J20 defendants in an enormous way. They have been an invaluable a group of supporters to us thus far. I didn't mean to cut you off, but
Shout
out to. Yeah, we love Tilted Scales.
Yeah, always cut me off. And I mean, like, when I was listening to them talk, it just reminded me a lot of, like, sort of conversations we were having earlier, just about how, like, you know, not every, you know, a lot of lawyers, you know, I've had to deal with lawyers in my life, and I have found them to not be the smartest people. All the time. I've actually been shocked by how stupid some lawyers are, but I guess that's another thing. But the Tilted Scales Collective, like, their framework is basically, like, when you are looking at political legal cases, you know, it's not cut and dry as it being, you know, it's not just about winning a court case, you know, it's about a bigger strategy. And so thinking about that, I guess I'm wondering, you know, why do we need more anarchist lawyers?
So I wouldn't say that lawyers are stupid. I would say, you know, 'cause I need a lawyer. I wouldn't say that. What I would say
all lawyers.
They have been trained in a very particular way. They have been trained along a certain line of ethics where they have one client, one individual who is their client, and that client is their priority. That is a matter of their ethics. They have to focus on you. And, you know, while at first glance that sounds really great, because, like, yeah, I want my lawyer to be thinking about me, when you are part of a movement, part of a collective, solidarity is about standing in that collective, right? And that is not something that most lawyers are trained to consider. That is not something that most lawyers are trained to prioritize. And that is not something that most lawyers tactically know how to engage with when it comes to collective bargaining, so that you can secure, for example, a global plea offer, which has been offered ubiquitously to all defendants in the case. Most lawyers have never experienced that. When you want to form joint defense agreements with your co-defendants so that your lawyers can share information with each other without the potential of necessarily incriminating you, that is not something they're very familiar with. When you choose to engage in the media, which can be necessary in a political campaign because you have to engage politically and that is wrapped up in the media, that's something that they discourage. You know, so we need anarchist lawyers and movement lawyers who understand our ethics, our politics, and understand that we as the defendants have to be empowered to lead the case. You'll find that many lawyers are hesitant to do that. They want you to decide, you know, are you going to go to trial and are you going to testify? And as an anarchist, that's very disempowering, because, like, I'm an anarchist because I make the decisions in my life. And we need lawyers who understand that. We need lawyers who understand that it is more about, that it can be about more than acquittals and dismissals. It is about building our movements. And we sure as hell need more lawyers. More lawyers who understand us.
Well, yeah.
Kids, go to law school.
It's too late. It's too late for me. I'm pushing 40. I'm sorry. I can't help.
That's all right. There are other ways of doing legal solidarity, like this podcast, for instance.
Maybe you're going to be the anarchist lawyer after all this.
If I don't wind up in prison, I've definitely thought about it. Hell, even if I do wind up in prison, I'll have time to read law books in there. Shit.
Oh, God. Well, we'll see.
We'll see.
You'll make a great lawyer, regardless.
Thank you.
So I forget the technical term for it, but one of the most troubling and fucking craziest things I've heard coming out of the repression J20 people are facing is these partner deals. What's that called?
So we have a term for that called wired pleas. And this is when the state comes to either two or more co-defendants with a plea on the condition that everyone accepts it. So, for example, in our case, the prosecution has really enjoyed using wired pleas against partners and couples and against groups of friends. My partner and I received a wired plea deal. My plea was for felony rioting, and theirs was for misdemeanor rioting. And this plea was extended to us under the condition that we both had to accept it. This is a pretty disgusting tactic that the state likes to engage in, because essentially it's them deciding that they're going to use our loved ones and their safety as a means of leverage against us, right? Because when our partners are in trouble, we want to protect them. That's as anarchists, that's what we do. We defend the people and the spaces and communities that we love. And, like, the state wants to use that against us. So they'll say, hey, you know, your partner can get off on a better plea deal. We'll just give them a misdemeanor, but you have to take that felony. Otherwise, we're taking you both to trial for 75 years. Jeez. And it's pretty despicable and grotesque.
It's a form of hostage taking.
Essentially, it's, you know, we have your partner and we can put them in a cage. So, you know, are you going to let that happen to them or are you going to take this plea? And it's like, well, I'm not letting that happen to them. You're the one who's going to put my goddamn partner in a cage and fuck you for doing that. You know, and it works. It is a tactic that works because it hits people like right where you fucking live. But in this case, folks who have resisted that have been able to unwire those pleas, which is certainly better than having them wired. It's pretty fucked up that the state can do that. It's one of the worst things that I've seen in this experience so far.
So what's the maximum penalty for felony rioting? 10 years?
10 years. The maximum penalty is 10 years.
And misdemeanor rioting is what, 1?
I'm actually not certain. Jeez. I don't think I can speak to that.
That's fucking insane. And again, it's like when we hear about, you know, when Democracy Now! Does its fucking 3 minutes on what happened. And I'll be real. Like, I'm not trying to put shit out there, but, like, I've been hitting people up, and I am shocked at how people at the, like, the top of the indie media world are not doing shit, really, to shine a light on what is the most insane repression. I mean, like, Standing Rock people aren't look. They're not all 800 of those people are not looking at 75 years. Yeah. You know. So how does it? I mean, do you have any thoughts on, you know, the quote unquote resistance and how like even indie media or mainstream media, like the people with a lot of influence, aren't stepping up and really shining a light on this? I mean, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I think that it's on the one hand to be expected, right? We are not owed any favors by the capitalist media, and we should not be expecting that, particularly after what we saw with the insane media blackout for months at Standing Rock. You know, you had tens of thousands of police officers brutalizing the shit out of water protectors at Standing Rock, and it just was dark over the mainstream media for months. We have had certain journalists come out of the mainstream media who have been very supportive and who have given us to the best of the mainstream media's capacity, favorable media, and they've been able to work with us. And to those of you, we appreciate it dearly. For indie media, I don't really know why there is currently a blackout. I don't entirely understand that. I think maybe, honestly, I think it has to do with the political climate in the country right now. There is an extremely violent fascist movement that is coalescing in this country right now that is targeting journalists. You know, they're being dog whistled by the Trump regime to focus on journalists. And I think that the combination of that and the property destruction, which allegedly took place during the inauguration, is scaring people. I think people are very legitimately scared right now. And I get that. I do. It's a very scary situation. But my hope is that people can work through that fear to come out and support us and to really start generating media around it. I think ultimately this situation demonstrates the very desperate need to start building counter-informational infrastructure, right? We need that in our local spaces and in our local regions. We need to start building our own infrastructure for creating counter-information and for presenting our communities with narratives that are not the bullshit coming out of Fox and CNN. Because if we don't have that, then when we see things like J20 or when we see things like what happened in Hamburg, you know, we have these very intense periods of resistance that get co-opted by the mainstream media, and then the narrative is skewed and distorted.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I get it too, I guess, but it's just, to me, it just seems so extreme that, like when I just think of, like, the typical Whole Foods shopper at Boulder, in Boulder, Colorado, close to where I live, you know, I just think, like, if they, you know, any one of those people could have been on the street, you know, with a, you know, I guess pussy hats hadn't been invented yet, but, you know, they could have been out there, and it could have been any one of them who were rounded up. And I just feel like people, if people were more familiar with the story, I think it would create a groundswell. But, you know, I mean, again, that's why we're doing this. That's why people keep pushing. And, exactly. You know, there's, you know, it went from 30 seconds on Democracy Now! To 5 minutes on the ACLU story. And, you know, next month it could be 15, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. We, you know, and that is the work that we as defendants need to engage in right now. You know, I just came from a letter writing event where, you know, for J20 as part of the Week of Solidarity, and this was in my community, and one of my neighbors came to the event and was like, "Well, what are you doing here?" And I told them, you know, I'm a J20 defendant. I'm facing 75 years in prison for such and such. And they were like, "I had no idea that this was happening." And that is true of all of our neighbors in all of our communities. And as scary as it is to be vocal and to be public, right now, defendants need to be getting into their communities. They need to be doing outreach. They need to be holding press conferences, because people need to know what is happening. They will support us if they know what is happening, because this situation is outrageous. Even for liberals, the idea of mass arresting 200 people and throwing them in prison for 75 years is not going to be acceptable. So that work has to get done, and, you know, we have to put the energy into doing it.
Right. Yeah, and I'm not giving up, and people listening shouldn't give up. They need to, you know, keep pestering these. I mean, fuck the mainstream media, and, you know, fuck the cognitive dissonance, but it's like, these are the platforms that are out there that so many people are getting their information through. And,
yeah,
you know, we're building up our own media. We're building up our counter information capacities. I mean, especially, you know, project like It's Going Down and Crime Pink and Submedia. And, I mean, Unicorn Riot. I mean, there are people out there doing it.
Soulcast.
Soulcast, yeah, right. Oh, God. But yeah, so, yeah, I'm not trying to, I guess I am bashing a little bit, but it's fine. Here's another question. How have these arrests impacted the organizing and activist work of others who were arrested? Or how has it impacted you? Like, what, I mean, you know.
Well, you know, it's taken me out of certain struggles that I feel very passionate about and very connected to, and that has been very hard. When this process began, I initially felt very much like a wounded soldier, in that I was engaged in these struggles that I was no longer able to participate in, because participating in them would jeopardize my legal situation. And in that sense, I felt very powerless. I felt wounded, and I felt very, very vulnerable in a way that I had never experienced before this repression got started. As the case moved forward, what I realized was not that I had been taken out of the battle. It was that the terrain had shifted. I had moved from one space of engagement to another because repression is a battlefield, right? And when I realized that, I immediately felt powerful again. And I felt that I could engage in organizing again. It pertains to this case, which is limited, and it's not all of the organizing that I want to do, because here in North Carolina, we have very, very serious problems that desperately need work and need people engaging with those problems. But realizing that I could still organize and could still fight back against the state in this case, that was a very powerful moment for me.
That's awesome. I mean, I know I've said it before, but I really commend your bravery, and, you know, that's the word I would use. And, you know, it's just listening to you talk, I'm just like, I just want to give you a hug, Carlo, and I can't.
So, yeah, I'm giving you a hug right through the moment right now, I promise.
Oh, shit. Well, you know, it's so inspiring hearing the stuff you're talking about and how you're approaching this. And I know you're not doing it alone, and you got a lot of support, and it's, you know, you're a real inspiration, and I'm sure I'm sure all the J20 defendants are, you know, who are organizing like you are on the same page, but it's just, you know, it's intense.
It is. And I have so many examples to inspire, I guess, that courage within me, because so many of my defendants have come out of the woodwork in the same way and just poured themselves into organizing and supporting defendants and building our defense. And those support people who have come into this case and just given so much of themselves to us, they are my inspiration. And, you know, they get me through my lows, because I have lows. You know, this is trauma. It has produced a level of anxiety and depression that I've never felt before. But your defendants and your comrades, they can get you through that if you let them, you know, and they have certainly helped me get through that. And I love them very deeply for that. And I appreciate them for that.
So there's people who listen to this podcast that are, you know, all over the country. They don't all live in Oakland and, you know, wherever the other anarchist hotspots are. You know, this is the kind of thing, like this kind of support for the J20 folks. This is something anyone can do from anywhere in the world, and I mean, y'all desperately need support. So I'm curious, like, you know, what are some things, what are some actionable things that people can do to help out with you know, with the J20 resistance repression situation? What can people do?
There are a lot of really wonderful ways that people can support us. We have a general defense fund that people can donate to, which is going to be very, very necessary. We have 200 defendants, so that's a lot of legal fees. That's a lot of travel fees, especially since we have defendants spread across the entire country. So donating is very, very helpful to us. Something that we need very seriously are movement lawyers. We need lawyers who understand this context, who understand our politics, to come out and represent defendants. That is that is going to be so critical for us in this case. So if there are lawyers listening right now, you know, give Dead City Legal Posse a call, send them an email, and let them know that you're willing to work on this case. For other folks, we have a statement of solidarity that you can sign on to through Action Network, which is, you know, just a small but a very visible way of showing your support. We have two active campaigns open right now. We have call-ins to Rochelle Howard at the Office of Police Complaints to demand that those funds, which they've allocated for the police investigation, they're being held until October 2017. We need them released now. We need this investigation to start now. So calling in and demanding that is going to be very helpful. We've also just begun a new campaign called Drop J20. This is our Drop the Charges campaign. We are asking folks to call in or write in to U.S. Attorney Channing Phillips to demand that these charges be dropped because the mass arrest was unlawful. It was in violation of D.C. law, the First Amendment's Assembly Act. It was in violation of the MPD's own standard operating procedures. Peter Newsham, the absolutely disgusting police chief of D.C., is currently breaking the law by refusing to hand over documents regarding how they handled that arrest to the to an organization in D.C. I forget the name right now. Hold on. I know that I have it. The Partnership for Civil Justice. They're demanding these documents, and Newsham will not hand them over. So calling in to Channing to demand that these things happen.
That is another. You broke up again. Could you just say the last sentence again?
Oh yeah. Calling in to a U.S. attorney Channing Phillips and demanding that these charges be dropped, demanding that those documents be released. That will help us. Other ways, just enhance the visibility of this case. That can be banner drops. That can be marches and rallies that are organized. That can be screenings and workshops organized in your community. Wheat pasting, if it is, you know, legal where you live to do wheat pasting, go do wheat pastings. Any way that you can increase the visibility of what is happening right now to sort of counteract the blackout that's happening in the media, that will also be very important for us.
But it's still money. Y'all still need money though, huh?
We still need money. Fundraisers and benefits. That is also another incredible thing that people can do for us. Organize benefits in your community. We're going to need money. Trial dates have been set. There are 198 trials from November of this year to October of the next. We are going to be swamped in legal fees, in CGA fees. So donating and organizing fundraisers, that is going to be extremely helpful for us.
Well, that's great. And what are the, like, I mean, I'll link them all on the, but what can you think of the web pages for more resources for this stuff? Do you know them off the top of your head?
Absolutely. There is defendj20resistance.org. That is our main platform for outreach. And if you go to defendj20resistance.org/support, you can find a list of all of the regional defense funds that we have up, as well as our national defense fund, and you can donate there. You can plug into our campaigns. You can follow us in the news. We regularly update the site. It is our best outreach platform. DefendJ20Resistance.org. Please check it out and follow it. Support us there. That'll be really, really helpful.
Well, I just want to thank you for taking the time and going on record and speaking about all this stuff. And, whatever, I'll be tracking your how this progresses for you and everyone else, and do what I can. Usually before Before I end every podcast, I like to ask people if they recommend any books. So if you have any like favorite books or a book that you've read recently that you want to shout out or you think everybody should read.
Well, right now I am super going to plug the Tilted Scales Guide to Being a Defendant. It is a masterclass in, you know, teaching new members to the movement how to deal with repression and how to handle being a defendant. I absolutely encourage that you read it. I also encourage that you read Crashing the Party by Chris Hermes. It is his work on the RNC 2000 cases and how they were able to successfully overcome that repression and get everyone out of that case without charges. It is a phenomenal book, and I encourage people to read both of them.
Awesome. Yeah, actually, one of my good friends was one of the conspiracy to riot people in the RNC. Shout out to Jared Paul. all right, well, any last thoughts before we go eat dinner or and watch the latest episode of Game of Thrones?
Don't stop fighting. Don't stop fighting right now. That is what the state wants. And if we give into that, they win. You know, I know that things look incredibly dark right now with what's going on, but continue to resist, continue to fight, and don't give them an inch. Not a single goddamn inch. Just keep fighting.
Dahlia never showed me nothing but kindness. She would say, I know how sad you get. And some days I still get that way, but it gets better. It gets better. It gets better. Sweetie, it gets better, I promise you. And she'd tell me, your heart is a muscle the size of your fist. Keep on loving, keep on fighting, and hold on.